The United States has once again backed Israel's devastating military campaign against Palestinians. The Palestinian Prime Minister calls for concrete action by the international community to stop Israeli killings in the Gaza Strip. And India reports more than 281,000 new confirmed COVID-19 cases and over 4,100 deaths. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Benis. Thanks for joining us. The United States has once again backed Israel's devastating military campaign against Palestinians. The U.S. Secretary of State said the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is to blame for the situation. Antony Blinken said that he is sorry about the Palestinian loss of lives, but insisted that Israel is entitled to defend itself. Blinken also touched upon Israel's bombing of Gaza Media Tower, saying that they have requested the details from Tel Aviv. Germany also echoed the U.S. support for Israeli attacks on Gaza.
The rocket attacks by Hamas must stop. Germany stands by Israel's side in this situation and by its right to protect its population and to defend itself.
Earlier, the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on Pope Francis to help end what he called Israel's massacre of Palestinians. In a phone call with the pontiff, Erdogan said that Israel must be punished with international sanctions. Meanwhile, Reporters Without Borders and Amnesty International blasted Israel for bombing a media tower in Gaza City. They said the deliberate bombing of the building is a war crime, accusing Israel of trying to obstruct media coverage of deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip. Several more Palestinians are killed as Israel presses ahead with its airstrikes and artillery attacks on different parts of the Gaza Strip. The latest fatalities include three in western Gaza, where a car was hit by a tank shell. One person was also killed in the city of Jabalia, north of Gaza City. Earlier, Israeli forces targeted a Palestinian government building and a factory. Warplanes also fired dozens of missiles overnight into different parts of the densely populated Palestinian territory. More than 200 Gazans have been killed, nearly 60 of them children, since Israel began pounding the region last Monday. More than 1,200 people have also been injured in Israeli attacks. Amnesty International has urged the International Criminal Court to investigate the regime's strikes on a media and residential tower, as well as a refugee camp, as war crimes. The Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shataya, has called for more concrete actions from the international community against Israel. Speaking from the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank, Shataya said that mere condemnations are not enough anymore. He urged the United Nations to issue a resolution that describes Israeli actions against the Palestinians as illegal and illegitimate. Shataya said the crimes that Israel has committed against the Palestinians have to be punished by international law. He called for an immediate end to the Israeli onslaught, saying that any delay means the renewal of Israeli killings or killing license against the Palestinians. The Palestinian premier also called upon allies to summon Israeli ambassadors and to halt trade relations with the regime. Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh rocket attacks on Israel, retaliation for the regime's relentless onslaught of the Gaza Strip. Hamas's military wing said its rockets hit Israeli settlements in Ashdod, injuring at least 8 people. The Ezzedine Al-Qassam brigades also hit the city of Netivot, as well as a number of military bases. Earlier, an Israeli battleship was hit by Palestinian rockets off the shore of the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, the Islamic Jihad movement said its military wing, Al-Quds brigades, fired volleys of rockets into the cities of Sderot and Netivot. So far, 10 Israelis have been killed and hundreds injured by Palestinian rocket fire.
Tensions in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank escalated after Israel launched a heavy-handed crackdown on worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli military pounded areas in the Gaza Strip, killing and injuring hundreds of civilians, among them women and children. But unlike the regime's other military campaigns against Gaza, Palestinian resistance groups responded forcefully to the aggression, launching a barrage of missiles and drones and inflicting heavy damage and casualties on the enemy. A top Israeli general has acknowledged the rising missile power of the Palestinian resistance groups, saying the Israeli regime is now faced with, quote, the highest ever rate of rocket attacks, In a press conference on Sunday, Major General Uri Gordon said Palestinian resistance groups based in Gaza had fired around 3,000 rockets toward the occupied territories over the past several days, surpassing the pace seen during an escalation in 2019 and the 2006 war with Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance group. In the meantime, violence has erupted across Israeli cities, with clashes between members of the Arab and Jewish communities increasing over the past week.
The violence within 48 Palestine alongside the resistance efforts from Palestinians all over Palestine is putting the Israeli regime in an unprecedented situation. Most of all, these developments display the weakness of the Israeli colonial project as such, and are also a danger for Israel's so-called security. Security, of course, meaning in the Israeli context, the successful continuation of the apartheid regime within 48 Palestine and the military occupation beyond. And the Palestinians in 48 Palestine have at best been second-class citizens. So, and Israel has used them for propaganda efforts to portray itself internationally as an alleged democracy with coexistence. And so this image is currently crumbling to some extent.
Also, the damage Israel is facing is thought to be much more severe when the economic impact of the incursion on Gaza is factored in.
Representatives from Palestine and Israel on Sunday blamed each other for the escalating conflict at a UN Security Council open debate. This is while Iran's permanent representative to the UN slammed the Security Council for its unjustified inaction and deadly silence on Israeli massacre of Palestinians. Majid Tahtar Avanchi said the Security Council's inaction has emboldened the Israeli regime to carry out its crimes with more savagery.
Palestinian demonstrations have been held in several cities around the world in the past few days, with protesters decrying the raids on the densely populated Gaza Strip. Protesters in the United States called for an immediate halt to all funds Washington provides to the regime. Calls for an end to the attacks were echoed by United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The current hostilities are utterly appalling. This latest round of violence only perpetuates the cycles of death, destruction, and despair, and pushes farther to the horizon any hopes of coexistence and peace. Fighting must stop. It must stop immediately.
Analysts say the Israeli army's attacks on the Gaza Strip on the one hand, and the raging conflict in the occupied West Bank on the other, will prove costly for the regime and will especially undermine its post-COVID-19 pandemic economic recovery.
The current events and the manifold proclamations of solidarity with Palestinians worldwide might actually have serious implications for Israel and for its economy, but it also needs to be seen how the situation will develop, because after all, it is the significant support of the United States, Germany, and the European Union that has kept Israel's economy and, of course, its oppressive apartheid regime alive.
Israel's closest ally, the United States, is also coming under fire for refusing to take a firm stance against the crimes being committed against the people of Palestine and blocking the United Nations Security Council meeting and statement on the issue. The international community's condemnation, together with the ramifications of the attacks on social unrest in the Israeli cities, would have bad optics for Israel, which is already grappling with political uncertainty amid the lack of a coalition cabinet.
India has reported more than 281,000 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 in 24 hours. The country has lost more than 4,100 more people to the coronavirus in the same period. The Indian Health Ministry says the number of total fatalities in the country has now surpassed 274,000, and the total caseload is nearing the grim milestone of 25 million. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has sounded the alarm over the rapid spread of the virus across the country. The World Health Organization has classified the Indian variant of the COVID-19 as a global concern, warning that the second year of the pandemic could be worse than the first. The grim situation has caused severe shortages of hospital beds and medical and oxygen supplies in the South Asian country. Iran says there will be no agreements in the Vienna talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal unless there's a consensus on all the issues. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Iran and the remaining parties to the landmark deal are continuing their technical negotiations. He said the Islamic Republic is not seeking an agreement that is not according to its policies and executive instructions. Khatibzadeh noted that Iran will give no access beyond the safeguards agreement to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Tehran has time and again said Washington has to take the first step towards reviving the nuclear deal by unconditionally removing all the sanctions in a verifiable manner. The U.S. withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on the country. It's time now to cross on over to our other studios to get all the news on Iran's 13th presidential election.
Well, Iran's Constitutional Council has held its first meeting to vet presidential hopefuls for next month's election. The council spokesman said that they examined the credentials and other documents submitted by the potential candidates. Abbas Ali Kathodai said the next meeting of the Constitutional Council will be held on Wednesday. The vetting body will release a final list of approved presidential candidates on May 26th and 27th. Nearly 600 people have registered to run for president. The hopefuls include Judiciary Chief Ibrahim Raisi, First Vice President Asghar Jahangiri, former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, and former Defense Minister Hossein Dehghan. Iran's 13th presidential election will be held on June 18th. Nearly 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote. Now, Iran's first vice president, Asghar Jahangiri, registered for the June 18th presidential election. This is the second time that he is running for the executive post. The following report takes a closer look at his profile.
Asghar Jahangiri was born in 1958 in Kerman. He holds a PhD in industrial management. Jahangiri began his political career following the 1979 revolution. He became the deputy head of the agriculture department in Kerman in 1980 and was appointed as its head 2 years later. Jahangiri has also served as a member of parliament for 8 years. He was appointed as the governor of Isfahan in September 1992 by then President Akbar Hoshemi Rafsanjani and held the position until 1997 when he was nominated by then President Mohammad Khatami as the Minister of Mines and Metals and was confirmed by the Parliament. His portfolio was later changed to the Minister of Industries and Mines. Jahangiri is the co-founder of Executive Construction Party and served as its Secretary General from 2006 to 2010. In 2013, after Hassan Rouhani won the presidential election, Jahangiri was appointed as the first vice president. He was nominated for the 2017 presidential election, but withdrew in the final days of campaigning and endorsed Rouhani. Later, after Rouhani won the election, Jahangiri was reappointed as first vice president. On May 15, Jahangiri registered to run for president. He called for a huge turnout in the vote to overcome the problems the country is facing. The first vice president described his ideal government as an entity at the service of the people. He said a practical government should respond to people's demands and act transparently. As a president, Jahangiri said he would pick honest people for his cabinet and resolutely fight any forms of corruption inside his administration.
Also, Iran's judiciary chief, Ibrahim Raisi, has officially declared his bid for presidency more than a month ahead of elections in Iran. The following report takes a look at his profile and the posts that he has held over the past years.
Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi is a prominent Iranian cleric who was born in 1960.
He has held several key posts in the judiciary branch since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, serving as the prosecutor of the cities of Karaj and Hamadan, as well as the capital Tehran. In 1994, Raisi was appointed as the head of General Inspection Office. He also served as first Deputy Chief of Justice of Iran and the Attorney General of the country. In March 2016, Raisi became the chairman of Astanbot Razavi. That's an umbrella administrative organization managing the holy shrine of the 8th Shia Imam in Mashhad and several other institutions. In March 2019, Raisi was appointed as the judiciary chief, a post he currently serves. Raisi is also an incumbent member of the Assembly of Experts. He has now announced that he will join the race for the June presidential election in Iran. Raisi registered for the election on May 15th and said he's running as an independent under the slogan of fighting corruption. Raisi says he wants to participate in the presidential poll because of public demand and has pledged change in managing the country's affairs. Raisi ran for president in the previous election in 2017 when he gained 38% of the vote. He ranked second behind incumbent president Hassan Rouhani.
And that was the latest that we have on Iran's presidential elections. And we'll be bringing you more updates, so stay tuned for this special segment that has been recently added to our news bulletin.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, played a key role in forming an alliance with pro-war Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee to repeatedly defeat the bipartisan anti-war minority to prevent any meaningful changes promised by former U.S. President Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign, to put an end to the U.S. posture of endless war. We now present you an article written by Glenn Greenwald under the heading, Liz Cheney Lied About Her Role in Spreading the Discredited CIA Russian Bounty Story. The article has appeared on the front page of the anti-war website. In an interview on Tuesday, 11th of May, with Fox News Channel's Brett Baier, U.S. Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican from Wyoming, denied that she spread the discredited CIA Russian bounty story. That CIA tale, claiming Russia was paying Taliban figures to kill U.S. troops in Afghanistan, was cooked up by the CIA and then published by the New York Times on 27th of June of last year, right as former President Donald Trump announced his plans to withdraw occupation forces from Afghanistan. The New York Times story, citing anonymous intelligence officials, was then continually invoked by pro-war Republicans and Democrats, led by Liz Cheney, to justify their blocking of the troop withdrawal. The story was discredited when the U.S. intelligence community admitted last month that it had only low to moderate confidence that any of this even happened. When Brett Baier asked Liz Cheney about her role in spreading this debunked CIA story, Cheney blatantly lied to him, claiming, "If you go back and look at what I said, every single thing I said if those stories are true, we need to know why the president and vice president were not briefed on them." After Brett Baier pressed her on the fact that she vested this story with credibility, Liz Cheney insisted a second time that she never endorsed the claim, but merely spoke conditionally, always using the "if these reports are true" formulation. Liz Cheney, as she so often does, blatantly lied. That she merely spoke of the Russian bounty story in the conditional, "every single thing I said if those stories are true," is completely and demonstrably false. Indeed, other than Representative Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, there are few, if any, members of Congress who did more to spread this Russian bounty story as proven truth, all in order to block troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. In so doing, she borrowed from a pro-war playbook pioneered by her dad, to whom she owes her career. The former vice president would leak CIA claims to the New York Times to justify war, then go on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, as he did on 8th of September 2002, and cite those New York Times reports as though they were independent confirmation of his views coming from that paper rather than from him. NBC's Tim Russert asks, "What specifically has Saddam obtained that you believe would enhance his nuclear development program?" Vice President Dick Cheney replied, "Now, in the case of a nuclear weapon, that means either plutonium or highly enriched uranium. And what we've seen recently that has raised our level of concern to the current state of unrest, if you will, if I can put it in those terms, is that he now is trying, through his illicit procurement network, to acquire the equipment he needs to be able to enrich uranium to make the bombs." Tim Russert asked, "Aluminium tubes?" Vice President Dick Cheney replied, "Specifically aluminium tubes. There's a story in the New York Times this morning. This is, I don't want to talk about, obviously, specific intelligence sources, but it's now public that, in fact, Saddam has been seeking to acquire, and we have been able to intercept and prevent him from acquiring, through this particular channel, the kinds of tubes that are necessary to build a centrifuge. And a centrifuge is required to take low-grade uranium and enhance it into highly enriched uranium, which is what you have to have in order to build a bomb. So having CIA stories leaked to the press that fueled the pro-war case, then having pro-war politicians cite those to justify their pro-war position is a Cheney family speciality. On 1st of July, the House Armed Services Committee, of which Representative Liz Cheney is a member, debated amendments to the National Defense Authorization Act, the bill that authorized $740.5 billion in military spending. One of Liz Cheney's top priorities was to align with the committee's pro-war Democrats, funded by weapons manufacturers, to block Donald Trump's plan to withdraw all U.S. occupation troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2020, and to withdraw roughly one-third of the 34,000 U.S. troops in Germany. To justify her position, Liz Cheney, contrary to what she repeatedly insisted to Brett Baier, cited the CIA's Russian bounty story without skepticism. In a joint statement with Representative Mac Thornberry, a Republican from Texas, ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, that Cheney published on her website on 27th of June, the same day that the New York Times published its first story about the CIA tale, Cheney pronounced herself concerned about Russian activity in Afghanistan, including reports that they have targeted U.S. forces. There was nothing conditional about the statement. They were preparing to block troop withdrawal from Afghanistan and cited this story as proof that Russia does not wish Americans well in Afghanistan. She said, "After today's briefing with senior White House officials, we remain concerned about Russian activity in Afghanistan, including reports that they have targeted U.S. forces. It has been clear for some time that Russia does not wish us well in Afghanistan. We believe it is important to vigorously pursue any information related to Russia or any other country targeting our forces. Congress has no more important obligation than providing for the security of our nation and ensuring our forces have the resources they need." An even more definitive use of this Russian bounty story came when Liz Cheney held a press conference to explain her opposition to Donald Trump's plans to withdraw troops. In this statement, she proclaimed that she remains concerned about Russian activities in Afghanistan. She then explicitly threatened Russia over the CIA's bounty story, warning them that any targeting of U.S. forces by Russians or by anyone else will face a very swift and deadly response. She then gloated about the U.S. bombing of Russia-linked troops in Syria in 2018, using what she called overwhelming and lethal force, and warned that this would happen again if they target U.S. occupation forces in Afghanistan. Does this sound even remotely like what Liz Cheney claimed to Brett Baier? She denied having played a key role in spreading the Russia bounty story because, as she put it, "every single thing I said, if those stories are true." She also told him that she never referred to the CIA claim except by saying, "if these reports are true." That is false. The issue is not merely that Liz Cheney lied, that would hardly be news. It is that the entire media narrative about Liz Cheney's removal from her House leadership role is a fraud. Her attacks on Donald Trump and her party leadership were not confined to criticisms of the role played by the former president in contesting the validity of the 2020 election outcome or inciting the 6th of January Capitol riot. Because Liz Cheney is such a stalwart defender of the need for truth and adherence to the rule of law in politics, Cheney played the key role in forming an alliance with pro-war Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee to repeatedly defeat the bipartisan anti-war minority, led by Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat, and Representative Matt Gaetz, a Republican from Florida, to prevent any meaningful changes promised by Donald Trump during the 2016 campaign to put an end to the U.S. posture of endless war. As I reported about the House Armed Services Committee hearing last July, the CIA tale was repeatedly cited by Liz Cheney and her allies to justify ongoing U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan. Liz Cheney is motivated by power and not ethics. In 2016, Trump ran and won by explicitly inveighing against the Bush-Cheney foreign policy of endless war, militarism, and imperialism that Liz Cheney, above all else, still vehemently supports. What she is attempting to do is reclaim the Republican Party and deliver it back to the neoconservatives and warmongers who dominated it under her father's reign. She is waging an ideological battle, not an ethical one, for control of the Republican Party. That will be a debate for Republican voters to resolve. In the meantime, Liz Cheney cannot be allowed to distance herself from the CIA's fairy tale about Russians in Afghanistan. Along with pro-war Democrats, she used this conveniently leaked CIA story repeatedly to block troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. And just as her father taught her to do, by example, if not expressly, she is now lying to distance herself from a pro-war CIA script that she, in fact, explicitly promoted.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 of Nahjul Balagha, famously known as the Sermon of the Pious. According to other versions of collections of the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam, they have numbered this particular sermon to be 191 or 192, depending on the collector of this book. We reached this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam brings about a very important quality of those who are pious and says that a pious person is one who لا يدخل في الباطل ولا يخرج من الحق. A pious person is one who doesn't enter into evil or does not enter into something that is wasteful or something that is false. الباطل ولا يخرج من الحق, and does not exit the truth, does not come out of the state of truth. And this is a very important quality. In fact, we are going to discuss here shortly as to what it means that a person remains to be in the path of truth.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this phrase of the sermon, says that one who is pious is one who does not exit the truth. It's as if he is always within the truth. He is always inside the truth. Now, when we say inside the truth, of course it is somewhat metaphorical, in the sense that you have to imagine that the truth is like a compartment, or you can say an area in which a person enters. It like covers that person. That means everything that surrounds him, everything, the way he reacts in different situations, is always the truth. لا يخرج من الحق. Now, that actually means that a pious person sets some purpose, sets some goals in life, and also has some principles in life, and also has certain actions that he performs, always maintain that state of truth around him. For some people, when they come across the universe, the way they look at the universe, the way they interact with the universe, is based on whims and without firm principles and without firm understanding. So sometimes you will notice people interpret what happens around the universe in a wrong manner. They do not have the insight to be able to see the divine actions of God. And that means that they have already exited the truth, because they have entered into a realm of whims. As soon as a person lacks that understanding, the true understanding about the universe, and does not have the right outlook towards the events that are occurring around him, and number three, doesn't react in the right manner, that is the time that he exits the truth. I will give you an example. When a person, for example, comes across an area where people are committing sins, right? This particular situation that has come about, even when there are people who are sinful and committing sins around him, and unfortunately he's in a position where he can't leave that place, the moment he has the right reaction and has the right outlook towards this phenomenon, he is inside the truth. So for example, he knows that all of these entities that are around him are a test for him now. They are things that Allah, with his permission, has allowed this to happen and has allowed me to be inside this situation. And because of this whole situation, Allah is testing me how I will react. Once he has this outlook, he's inside the truth. But this outlook is not enough. After that, he needs to make the right reaction. So if in this situation he controls himself and rather stops himself from committing those sins, and even then, above that, begins to guide people towards the right path and to stop them from committing wrong, at that moment he will be within truth. But the moment he gets the wrong outlook, that means when he sees the people around him committing these sins and these crimes, and he ignores it or says that that is their life and that is I, so then I have my life. This itself is a wrong outlook. Now, unfortunately, he has exited the truth and he has entered the realm of falsehood. And of course, when he after that commits evil crimes and mistakes and follows the path of falsehood, he has entered into the state of falsehood.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So what is important for a pious person is the right outlook, the right ways to react. And the right ways to react are always following the commandments of God, the Sharia. Because the commandments of God, when you realize that ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّ اللَّهَ هُوَ الْحَقِّ, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the absolute truth. the truth that exists in the universe, that entity upon which everyone depends, everything depends. He gives meaning and value to everything. At that moment, if a person were to adhere to the teachings that are coming from such a God, to the commandments of such a God, of such an entity, they are in the truth. The moment they separate themselves, the moment they disobey, that means they are separating themselves from the truth. They are exiting from that environment of truth. And they are now entering an environment, a whimsical environment that they are creating themselves. They are performing actions. They are not real. They are against his human dimension and are therefore taking him lower and further away from reality. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he gives us the opportunity to follow the truth and to stick to it and to always remain in that path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A third of global food production will be at risk by the end of the century if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at their current rate, new research has suggested. Many of the world's most important food-growing areas will see temperatures increase and rainfall patterns alter drastically if temperatures rise by about 3.7 degrees Celsius. The forecast increase if greenhouse gas emissions stay high. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent, Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Third of Global Food Production at Risk from Climate Crisis. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. A third of global food production will be at risk by the end of the century if greenhouse gas emissions continue to rise at their current rate, new research has suggested. Many of the world's most important food-growing areas will see temperatures increase and rainfall patterns alter drastically if temperatures rise by about 3.7 degrees Celsius. The forecast increase if greenhouse gas emissions stay high. Researchers at Aalto University in Finland have calculated that about 95% of current crop production takes place in areas they define as safe climatic space, or conditions where temperature, rainfall, and aridity fall within certain bounds. If temperature were to rise by 3.7 degrees Celsius or thereabouts by the century's end,
that safe area would shrink drastically, mostly affecting South and Southeastern Asia and Africa's Sudano-Sahelian zone, according to a paper published in the journal One Earth on Friday. However, if greenhouse gas emissions are reduced and the world meets the goals of the Paris Agreement in limiting temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees C above pre-industrial levels, then only about 5% to 8% of the global food production would be at risk. Matti Kummu, an associate professor of global food and water at Aalto University in Finland and the lead author of the paper, says, "A third of global food production will be at risk. We should be worried, as the climate safe space is quite narrow. But there are measures we can take in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and we should empower people and societies in the danger zones to reduce the impact and increase their resilience and adaptive capacity. Although rising temperatures could increase food production in some areas that are currently less productive, such as the Nordic regions, that would not be anywhere near enough to offset the loss of important food-producing regions in the south," said Kummu. "There will be winners as well as losers, but the wins will be outweighed by the losses, and there is just not enough space for food production to move. We are already at the limits," he said. "Livestock farming would be affected as well as the risk to crop production," he said, "and many areas were likely to suffer large increases in water scarcity." The researchers examined the impact of climate changes on 27 of the most important food crops and 7 types of livestock. By the end of this century, in a high-emission scenario, there could be as much as 1.5 million square miles or 4 million square kilometers of new desert around the world, the researchers found. Under 1.5 degrees Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius of warming, the boreal forests of Northern America, Russia, and Europe would shrink from their current 7 million square miles to about 6 million square miles by 2100. In a high-emission scenario, only 3 million square miles would remain, according to the researchers. The paper adds to previous research that has found that global heating is already having an impact on agricultural productivity. Earlier research has shown that the climate crisis is already eating into the output of the world's agricultural systems, with productivity much lower than it would have been if humans hadn't rapidly heated the planet, new researchers found. Advances in technology, fertilizer use, and global trade have allowed food production to keep pace with a booming global population since the 1960s, albeit with gross inequities that still leave millions of people suffering from malnutrition. But rising temperatures in this time have acted as a handbrake to farming productivity of crops and livestock, according to the new research published in Nature Climate Change. Productivity has actually slumped by 21% since 1961, compared to if the world hadn't been subjected to human-induced heating. With the global population set to rise to more than 9 billion by 2050, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, has estimated that food production will have to increase by about 70%, with annual crop production increasing by almost 1 billion tons and meat production soaring by more than 200 million tons a year by this point. Meanwhile, global temperatures are rising at a rate that scientists warn is extremely dangerous for human civilization. "The impact already is larger than I thought it would be," said Ariel Ortiz-Bobia, an economist at Cornell University who led the research. Ariel Ortiz-Bobia says,
It was a big surprise to me. The worry I have is that research and development in agriculture takes decades to translate into higher productivity. The projected temperature increase is so fast, I don't know if we're going to keep pace with that. The research measured productivity by inputs, such as labor, fertilizer, and equipment, and the output in food they produce, using a model to determine how climate change has influenced this relationship. While farming has generally become far more efficient in recent decades, it is increasingly menaced by heat waves and that exhaust farm workers and wither certain crops. Extreme weather events and drought can also affect the output of a farm, particularly smaller farm operations in poorer countries. In 2019, scientists who analyzed the top 10 global crops that provide the majority of our food calories found that climate change is reducing the worldwide production of staple crops such as rice and wheat. Again, less affluent countries are suffering worse from this situation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Short wave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the hadith of the Aql and the Jahl, or rather the armies or the battalions that are contained within these two, you know, chiefs and captains, we come to this segment of the hadith of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he mentions again two other traits. One of the traits that the Imam mentions is rifq, which means kindness, you know, softness. And this is different from what we mentioned previously. That was a person who was soft-hearted. This is a person in his actions and in the way he, you know, behaves. Yes, there are definitely a relationship between the two. That if a person is soft in his actions, it results or it means that he has a soft heart. If a person is hard-hearted, obviously the result will be that in his outward nature and in his outward actions, he will be harsh and hard with people. So yes, we can see that this interacts with one of the previous segments. So here the Imam says that warifq, that is, you know, that type of kindness, that type of, you know, being soft, being friendly, being, you know, a person who is a companion of others. Comes from the word rafiq. Rafiq means to befriend or be a friend. So these type of things is something that is good. To be soft-hearted, to be kind, you know, to listen, to be a so-called a ear that others can speak to, a shoulder for others to cry on and so forth. And then obviously the Imam says that that trait which is in direct conflict with this kindness, with this softness, with this, you know, this ability to interact with people in a good manner is khurq, or this harshness and this hardness that a person has. Like for example, if a person who is in need, a faqir, comes up to you and you honestly don't have anything, there are two ways you can go about it. If a person is kind, if a person is soft, in a very, you know, humble way, in a very kind way, he will tell you, sorry, I do not have anything for you. Please forgive me. This is one way of doing it. On the other hand, a person says, go away from me, I don't have anything for you. Why are you coming to me? This is another way that a person can do it. And we've seen it. I'm sure most of us have examples of this in our own lives. That we've seen either ourselves do it or others do it. And hopefully, inshallah, we are doing it in the first way. That if we honestly cannot help, we reject in a very humble, in a very kind, in a soft manner. And not in a harsh way. And not in a way that, you know, will bring insult to the person who is asking. Again, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that all of these good traits that the Imam mentions, that we are able to inculcate them, and all the bad traits that the Imam mentions, we're able to distance ourselves from them. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be there.